Well, there could be no better companion for the preparation of food than my next guest. And barring the possibility of having him sitting in your kitchen peeling potatoes while you prepare your meal, or having him sit next to you and tell you a story on a long trip to some Thanksgiving feast, no, the next best thing to having writer Adam Gopnik right there with you is his grand book, The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. And consider him your companion for the next few minutes. Adam, welcome to the program.
It's wonderful to be here, John.
So first, let's talk about people who are preparing food and listening to media of one kind or another. We learn in this book that a cook can only focus on certain things, and television is not one of them when they're preparing food.
You can't watch television and cook at the same time. There are things you can do. Listen to music, obviously, is one. Listen to the radio is another. Listen to your own thoughts is one more. One of the things I talk about in the book is it's become a real convention now in contemporary literature to have somebody cooking when they have to think their way through a difficult problem. In 19th century literature, you usually sent them on a walk. George Eliot or Trollope would send those people on a good long country walk. And in sort of mid-century fiction, John Updike or Ann Tyler, they would always be sent in a long car drive. But in our time, when somebody has to do a lot of hard thinking, we have them hard at work making a casserole.
And they're hard at work doing things that we long to be a part of, but are not necessarily part of the story. You have literary categories for why and where food comes up. I wonder if you'd explain those.
Let me see if I can recall them all. There's one thing that happens often is you have food in literature that's there just to be a sign of who someone is. If a Trollope clergyman eats his steak and porter, you know, that's because he's a clergyman. Then you have food, like the food in the James Bond books. People forget how much great food there is in Ian Fleming's James Bond books, which is there for the author to eat instead of the character.
Right.
So that, you know, Bond is constantly getting, we get long menus of his eating caviar and then squab and pigeons, things that don't sound like what a paid assassin would typically eat. But you know that Ian Fleming was someone who loved his caviar on just the right amount of toast. There's a wonderful line in one of the Bond books, Moonraker, I think, where he says, the problem isn't getting enough caviar, it's getting enough toast to go with it. When I read that when I was 11, I said, that's the way to live, right?
But you tell us, as a good reporter in this book, that in fact that's preposterous. The problem with caviar is not the toast at all.
No, the problem with caviar is not the toast. The problem with caviar is the caviar wandering from the world. That's when you're 12, you think, aha, someday I will tell somebody it's the toast, not the caviar. When you're past 40, you know it's the caviar, not the toast.
I'm even more struck by the story of where recipes came from, which is part of the story of this book.
Yeah, this, you know, sort of the two pillars of modern eating are the restaurants, the place you go, and the recipe, which is what you cook from when we're at home, those of us who, like you and me, who live to do this thing. And what's fascinating about the recipe book is the first recipe books are really sort of abbreviated guide for pros. You know, you're in your kitchen, you're a caterer or a cook, and you say, how do you make that damn sauce bernaise? And you look at it quickly. And then they emerge as ways for middle-class women to learn how to behave in the kitchen. At a time in the mid-19th century, in England particularly, the restaurant's a French invention, but the recipe book is mostly an English invention because cooking in France was still done mostly by pros, which says, you've got this family, you've got to feed them, here's how you do it well. And so you get the recipe book in the 19th century. And then you begin to get one of my favorite variants, the narrative recipe book, which I associate with the British writer Elizabeth Pennell, who's an important character in the book. And then we end up in our own day with a kind of cookbook you and I have to deal with. It's things that you will never be able to make, prepared with methods that you will never be able to master, and yet nonetheless which you will continue to aspire to as long as you have a kitchen.
We're speaking with Adam Gopnik, author of The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Our conversation continues in a moment. Continuing our conversation with Adam Gopnik about food and the meaning of food. He's the author of The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. You know, the Thomas Keller cookbook, the French Laundry cookbook, which is one of the original food pornography kinds
of
coffee table cookbooks. You spill some béarnaise sauce on it and
you feel horrible.
You feel horrible. Yeah. What would Thomas say?
Right, exactly.
But he must want you to actually try these recipes, yet when you enter into this book, it's all about this relationship with fish that you wish you had, and the fishmonger.
And
who,
his purveyors, exactly.
Oh, my God, his purveyors.
No, it's a very big thing about that book is his purveyors. He introduces you to his purveyors, which is great for Thomas, right? But not hugely helpful for somebody who's going to be running across the street. I do one thing from that cookbook, which is a very good cookbook. It has, do you remember, 15 pages on how to truss a chicken.
Yes.
And I've occasionally trussed a chicken for the fun of it. But I do, he has a wonderful recipe for short ribs, which only has about 18 separate steps spread out over four
and special
separate
sauces.
Days.
And,
exactly.
Yeah.
And but you know what? At the end of the time of it all, it's worth it. So I do that one. But that's almost easy compared to some of the others. You know, you'll find the modernist cooks, you know, the guys from Barcelona who do molecular cooking now have cookbooks, and you need to have a sous vide machine, one of those specially made things in which you put all the meats in seal tight plastic bags and you boil them essentially at set temperatures. We have a friend who lives upstairs from us in our building in New York, and he has built his own sous vide machine. That is foodieism above and beyond, I think.
Can
Not
you,
just the call of duty, but a responsibility.
Can you win a Nobel Prize for chemistry these days?
I think so. I mean, the key thing that happened, right, it was the last or latest big revolution in food, is when those guys, the Adria brothers around El Bulli in Barcelona, really did form an alliance with a chemist at the University of Barcelona and said, let's take all of these techniques, many of which were designed for industrial food, freeze-drying things, turning things into foams and into gels, things that were not for good food but for mass food, and said, let's try and apply them to our art. Let's try and make them artful. And so they have, you know, you have tasted them and I have tasted them, you know, the sea urchin brains with the sea urchin foam decorated with the goat brain tapioca. And, you know, I've been to those places. I write about them in the book. Once your resistance breaks down, because in the original place in Barcelona where Adria and his disciples all cook, it's essentially a form of circus, John. You know, it's meant to be fun. You're there. You're not paying. You're paying for the food, but essentially it's a form of show. It takes us back almost to the kind of 18th century roots of fancy cooking, where it was as much about the giant pièce montées that showed the sack of Rome laid out in pastry as it was about the taste of it. The problem, I think, is that when a lot of that style has been translated into America, if you go to the fancy molecular place in most American cities, it's insanely churchy. You know, Americans, we're good at moralizing things. Give us anything and we'll moralize it. Military affairs or Spanish cooking. So we're not content just to say, sit back, this is going to be wacky and fun. We have to say, this will change your life. If you just follow the bouncing salts, right, the volcanic salt, the Himalayan salt, the pink deep sea salt, and so on. We take things awfully seriously.
Two quick details before we go. One, you confess in here that you have made a recipe of your own, only one and kind of, but you don't tell what it is, at least not the part of the book that I read where you confess that. And secondly, I want to thank you for saying it's actually okay when you cut up orange rinds to throw in your bouillabaisse that you don't get all the little white stuff out of there. It actually doesn't matter at all.
One of the things, you know, Nigella Lawson, wonderful cookbook writer, and one of the things I love about Nigella is she's messy, right? And she tells you, it's okay to be messy. Nobody will notice. Everyone will enjoy it about equally. And that, I think, is a terribly liberating thing. My one invention in the world of cooking, where I am a total amateur, is, remember in Alice Through the Looking Glass, the White Knight has inventions that have never been tried but that would work well. It occurred to me you can make a wonderful béarnaise sauce, which, as you know, is normally made just with tarragon and butter, if you use the wonderful Thai herbs, basil and mint and cilantro all together. Wouldn't that be good? And you know what? It was darn good. So that is my one and only, my first and my final contribution to the world's culinary literature, apart from the reflective kind I do, Bangkok béarnaise.
Happy Thanksgiving, Adam Gopnik.
Happy Thanksgiving, John.
Adam Gopnik is the author of The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food.